lot of threats, wishing death upon me, telling me that, you know, I'll be in jail with my mother, and saying things like, be glad it's 2020 and not 1920.
Were a lot of these threats and vile comments racist in nature?
A lot of them were racist. A lot of them were just hateful.
Powerful testimony from Shae Moss, the former Georgia election worker who testified before the January 6th committee hearing yesterday. She and her mother, Ruby Freeman, who was also an election worker, said they were the objects of fury by Trump supporters after Rudy Giuliani accused them of fraud. They had to flee their homes for a while. Armed protesters barged into Shae's grandmother's home. She's still afraid to leave her house now. The committee will hold its fifth hearing tomorrow, focusing on former President Trump's efforts to pressure the Justice Department to help undo the 2020 presidential election. Former Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen, who took over after William Barr resigned, and other former top DOJ officials will testify. We're going to look back at what we've learned so far and what may be revealed tomorrow and in coming days with Aaron Blake, senior political reporter at The Washington Post, and he writes their column, The Fix. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
Good to have you back. And Zach Womp is a former Republican congressman from Tennessee who's been critical of Donald Trump and is a member of Issue One's National Council on Election Integrity. That's a nonpartisan organization. Welcome to you.
Well, thank you for having me, Madeline.
Great to have you. Aaron, let's begin with you and let's talk about Georgia and that poll worker, Shae Moss. There were allegations made that Democrats were funneling votes into Georgia's system, and the Trump campaign said they had video evidence. Turned out that that evidence was actually a ginger mint mistaken for a USB drive. What is going on there? What happened?
Well, I think that Shae Moss and her mother were involved in this hearing because this particular example really drove home, at the very least, how careless these voter fraud theories were. A lot of them were very nonspecific. They didn't necessarily involve individual people who could be singled out. But in this case, both her and her mom were effectively accused by crimes on conservative media. They were called out by name. And it wasn't just, alluding to potential wrongdoing. It was them being accused of specific things. And so the hearing yesterday was very much geared toward driving home that human cost mm-hmm. of this voter fraud crusade. And I think that they are a kind of a case in point when it comes to that.
Right. Also, Rusty Bowers also he paid quite a cost in terms of protesters targeting him. He was a Republican speaker of the Arizona House of Representatives and at the time pressured by Giuliani in particular. Here he's talking about a phone call he had with Giuliani.
My recollection, he said, we've got lots of theories. We just don't have the evidence. And I don't know if that was a gaffe or maybe he didn't think through what he said, but both myself and others in my group, the three in my group and my counsel, both remembered that specifically. And afterwards, we kind of laughed about it.
All right, Zach. So two instances here of Giuliani involved acting, in a surprising manner, to say the least. But this is a broader situation. There's a broad network of operatives working here to overturn the 2020 election. What is your reaction to everything we've learned so far?
Well, like most Americans, I haven't watched it all. I've been busy. I was somewhat leery of it to begin with because of when it happens with the hearings right before this most important midterm when Democrats are expected to lose. But I've also been pleasantly surprised at how much substance has come out of these hearings and how many things have actually been revealed that weren't known. I mean, the average person would have no idea that at the very end, President Trump had almost no one around him giving him input except a drunk Rudy Giuliani. And I mean drunk most of the time. And so there were attempts. In a sense, it was like the Keystone Cops, though, because they were so inept at what they were trying to do. And it's very obvious that they were trying to do it. But I mean, all of the sound advisors basically had turned away or told the president the truth that he didn't want to hear. And so they kind of walked away, and some were loyal to the very end. But my goodness, it was very obvious that you know, on January the 6th itself, it was only Giuliani that was speaking to him. And so many people like Bill Barr had told the truth. What I'm amazed at about this committee's work is that most of the real revelations have come from Republicans, from Raffensperger, mm-hmm. from Bowers, from Mick Mulvaney, from Bob Barr. Bill Barr. It is amazing, really, that Republican voices have now gained this kind of credibility. I served with Mike Pence. I served with Mark Short, his chief of staff. These are people that can be trusted. And at the end of the day, they did the right thing on behalf of our country. You said in the intro there that I've been critical of Donald Trump. I've actually only been critical of things that weren't true. Mm-hmm. I've told the truth about everything from the election to January the 6th. And if you stand on the truth, sometimes people in your own party are not going to feel comfortable about it. But these hearings have clearly shown that they were up to no good and that they thought that they could actually somehow overturn this election. And it led to this gross day. And some people don't want to acknowledge that it was an insurrection, but it should never happen again. And I've never been madder at what happened in this city that I'm sitting in now, Washington, D.C., than the day of January the 6th, because I served here. And I think public service is a noble profession. I think American exceptionalism is defined most of all by the fact that we have free and fair elections carried out by our fellow citizens. And after the elections, we accept the results and we peacefully transfer power. No other country in the history of the world has done that as well as we have. It's not perfect, but we are exceptional in that we always accept the results. This group did not do that.
Well, let me ask you about Pence, because you mentioned that you worked with him, you respect him, and he has been held up as the guy who said, I'm not going to go along with this scheme at the crunch moment. And Jamie Raskin, Democrat from Maryland, had called him a hero. However, Pence did not support the second impeachment. So what do you make of that?
Well, Mike Pence, you know, vice presidents have been mocked throughout history, you know, for the role that they play. And it's not much. You know, they somebody said this morning that they were supposed to just check on the president's health every day and see how the president's mm-hmm. doing. So they're loyal, you know, and I was surprised how loyal Mike Pence was the whole time. But what this whole ordeal with Pence shows more than anything else is that President Trump will turn on anyone, including the person that's been the most loyal to him, if they don't agree with him 100% of the time. And that even caused Ivanka and Jared to take a step back. These hearings and their testimony caused me to think, man, this had to be painful even inside the family. So mm-hmm. these are all things that the American people can look at, make their own decision about. You know, I've got a lot of friends that think this is much ado about nothing and that this is all political. And then I've got other friends that think, man, this is awful and we need to make sure it never happens again. And then I have other friends who think this is the worst thing that's ever happened in the history of the country. And it's obviously somewhere in between, but Americans can make their own judgment. What I think has happened here is that, you know, Cheney and Kinzinger weren't the only people speaking out here in these hearings. It was a lot of other Republicans saying, this is wrong. And a lot of Republicans are wanting to find out at what point can we move on and leave this awful episode behind us, bring forth some new candidates and rebuild the party based on the future instead of the past. And in order to do that, we might have to go through this process.
Right. And the problem is, Aaron, is you don't hear from a lot of those other Republicans, right? There's a story in your paper, an analysis that says 100 plus election deniers are now on the November ballot, and most are in Republican leaning districts. And so they would probably win. They are considered likely to win in their races. Several of them are for the U.S. Senate, 86 for the House. So why is it just Kinzinger and Cheney, whom we see on the Republican side, most publicly criticizing what happened on January 6th?
Well, it's a really good point, and I'm glad Congressman Womp talked about how there are Republicans who are kind of the biggest voices in these hearings so far, even though there are only two on the actual committee. After the election, I wrote about kind of the party's divergence on the stolen election claims, and what I found was that In most of the cases in which Republican office holders were forced to make a decision, whether it be certifying the election results or addressing the specifics of some of these claims, like Secretary Raffensperger in Georgia, they very often sided against Trump. So the people who were forced to make a decision about these things were on the side of this thing being a fantasy. But the vast majority of Republicans were not forced into making those decisions. And as the time passed after the insurrection, they were allowed to kind of form their thoughts on this and to hew their comments towards Donald Trump, even if they weren't completely echoing the idea that the election was stolen or that there was widespread voter fraud. And it's become clear that the party as a whole has moved towards believing those things. And the easiest thing for these Republican primary candidates to do is at least offer a version that will give those people license to believe that they are on their side, or that they think there are at least very significant problems with the 2020 election. But it is a significant, it's very telling that we're seeing all these Republican witnesses and high ranking ones too, state house speakers in Pennsylvania and in Arizona, high ranking state right officials in Georgia. I mean, these people were forced to make a decision, and they basically have had to tell the truth because they staked out their position very early on.
And I guess the question is, and I'll put it to you, Congressman Zach Wamp, in the last few seconds that we have, do you think that this will move the needle at all when it comes to Trump supporters?
Well, I think it gives power, encourages those who want to stand on the truth. And you've seen some candidates like Katie Britt won yesterday in Alabama, and Mo Brooks lost decisively. And that's where, you know, she wasn't willing to accept all of this. You know, she did throw some, you know, carrots to the people saying there probably was fraud, but not enough to overturn an election, whatever. And she won. So the more of these things that happen and the more people that feel comfortable, let me tell you, there's a lot of intimidation going on. You hear it. You feel it. People can be afraid. And so as a result, they need to be empowered. More Republicans are empowered now to stand on the truth. Even I saw where President Trump said that McCarthy should have not pulled the Republicans off his committee so that it was more balanced. Well, wait a second. He did that at the behest of them. You know, our group, Issue One in the National Council on Election Integrity that I serve on, we wanted a 9/11 type commission where politicians wouldn't be on the commission. They rejected it. They opted for this. And then they pulled the Republicans off of this to only leave two. And then President Trump says we should have had more Republicans left on the thing. So all of these revelations kind of warm up the public to tell the truth. So we need to get the American people to stand on the truth.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. Zach Wamp, former Republican congressman from Tennessee. Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Coming up, what happened to the 3,000 residents when billionaire Larry Ellison bought their Hawaiian island of Lanai? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, for decades, the Hawaiian island of Lanai has stood out from the tourist spots. It is sleepier. It is less crowded. There's just one school, one hospital, and just a handful of resorts. Until the 1990s, the economy was more dependent on pineapple plantations than tourism. 10 years ago, Oracle billionaire Larry Ellison bought almost the entire thing, including nearly all the businesses and housing. He paid just $300 million for most of Lanai. For the people who live there, Ellison was suddenly their boss and their landlord. And now locals say the island has become a playground for the rich as they are being edged out. Sophie Alexander is a wealth reporter for Bloomberg News. She recently visited Lanai and wrote about it, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi there.
Well, let's first talk about Larry Ellison. He is doesn't talk a lot to the press. He's pretty secretive, co-founder of Oracle. And I understand that on any given day, he's worth around $90 billion. So he's one of the richest men in the world. Tell us more about him.
That's right. He is very low-key. He's one of those Silicon Valley billionaires that I feel like a lot of people have never really heard of. But like you said, he's worth $90 billion. So it's just an insane amount of money, you know, that started with Oracle, the software company, and now a lot of his wealth is also in Tesla. Until recently, he was on the board there, and he's pretty close with Elon Musk, and, you know, Musk makes his way to the island as well.
So why did he want to buy this island?
Well, you know, like we talked about, he doesn't talk very openly, but I spoke with David Agus, who is his partner in Sensei, which is a wellness company for resorts and an agricultural business. And Agus was Steve Jobs' cancer doctor and is close with Larry. And when we talked, he told me that, you know, Larry, when he was a kid, he remembers flying over the Hawaiian Islands and sort of being, you know, enamored by their beauty. And so when Lanai became available, of course, when you're a billionaire, you can buy a Hawaiian island. So why not?
And what is $300 million if you have $90 billion?
Exactly. Exactly. It's really a drop in the bucket.
So he bought it 10 years ago because he liked the look of it. And did he just want to hang out there or did he want to have an active hand in this island?
So Lanai's weird. I mean, a lot of billionaires sort of have these pet projects, you know, whether they own a sports team or they're big art collectors. This seems like it's sort of become that kind of thing for him. You know, it is like a self-contained community because it's an island of 3,000 people. So it's basically like this little community that he controls. It's kind of like that game Sims or, you know, one of those model train sets. Yeah. But it's like a, you know, in real life, of course.
Well, so what happened to the 3,000 people when he became basically their overseer, their landlord, their employer? What happened to them?
For most of the people on the island, Ellison became their boss because he was now in control of the hotels there. And that's what employs most of the population. So it's pretty difficult to live on Lanai and not be touched by Larry in one way or another. You know, over the years, with $90 billion, he just kept buying up more and more. He bought the grocery store. He bought the gas station more recently. He bought the community newspaper. So even if you don't work for him or even if you don't rent from him, you're still shopping at his grocery store. You're still buying gas from his gas station. So basically, he just came to control pretty much every aspect of life there. And it very for some. The biggest difference, it seemed, was for the small businesses. We opened the story with this man named Chris Andrus, who came to Lanai a couple years before Ellison bought it to help his friend with this woodworking business. The woodworking business rented from a space that Ellison bought, essentially, so he became their landlord. It seemed like things were going to go as normal. You know, they were used to renting from a billionaire. A billionaire owned it before Larry. But then all of a sudden, Ellison decides, you know what? I want to use this space. Either you can sell me the business, the woodworking business, or you can clear out. And so they sell it. And then 6 years later, Peter Franklin, the person who owns the business, they tell him, you know what, we're shutting the woodworking business down. Sorry, you're out of a job, with no explanation. And because both Chris and Peter actually rent their homes from Ellison too, it's more difficult because for Peter, he was essentially laid off from one of Ellison's companies. And there's a stipulation in the residential leases that if you work for one of the landlord's companies and are terminated or are let go or for whatever reason, that's grounds to be kicked out of your home. So Peter lives in fear basically every day that the company could come say, get out, you can't live here anymore.
And what about Chris? What is he going to do?
So Chris, there wasn't a job for him when they sold the woodworking business. So it's a little more complicated. They don't have grounds to kick him out of this home. But when he stopped working for the woodworking business because there wasn't a job for him, he started delivering papers around the island. And that, you know, has put a struggle on his finances. He's been struggling financially. And there really aren't very many other jobs to get that don't make Ellison your boss on the island. And with the help of charities, he was able to pay some back sewage bills, back energy bills, and prevent eviction. But, you know, it feels like any other time something else could come up and they could say, oh, well, you did this, so get out.
So this guy, Chris, went from working in this woodworking company to becoming a paper boy, a delivery boy for newspapers who couldn't then pay his rent or struggle to pay his rent because of his lower salary.
That's right. That's right. And it's not just the woodworking business. There's also the pokey shop. You know, there's a family-owned pokey shop that everyone really liked. When Ellison bought the grocery store, he introduced a pokey bar with lower prices. And pretty much everyone on the island still, you know, feels sour about that now. And there's also the car rental business. Just a whole lot of small businesses that have suffered as a result.
And so what does Larry Ellison or his company, what do they say about that? How do they defend themselves that they're driving these people out of business and many of them into financial desperation?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's not, they don't say very much publicly, but if you dig back through documents, you know, because it's part of Maui County, Lanai residents have the opportunity to pose questions to the company when they're asking to build something or, you know, when they're looking for permits for XYZ. So if you look back, there is one resident, Robin Kay, who asked about, you know, why are you introducing a poke bar at Richard's Market if it's going to hurt Ohana Poke Market? And one of the representatives of Ellison's company said, well, we think competition is good.
Well, so meanwhile, does he live there at all? Does he show up?
Yes.
He does.
So he moved there during the pandemic, like, you know, a lot of other rich people moving out of the Bay Area. Now residents sort of see more of him because he's driving around in his orange Corvette, but still he does not have a relationship with the community.
He doesn't talk to them.
No, he does not.
What is the long-term plan for the island and where is it headed?
So he hasn't said much about this again, but the thing that he does keep bringing up over and over is that he wants to make it a sustainable island. And it's kind of confusing when you ask different people what their interpretation of that is. Some people think it means, oh, well, he wants the community to be self-sustainable. He doesn't want us to depend on him. But others say, well, obviously he means environmentally sustainable. And, you know, he does have a lot of Tesla products all over the island. So it does seem like that is an effort of his. You know, he's doing conservation projects, but then there are people who are very involved in conservation. I spoke with a man who's native Hawaiian, who's a seventh generation Lanaian, who's really frustrated because he wants to be involved in these conversations because he's an expert in the area, but Ellison won't engage with him at all.
So is there anything the residents can do? I mean, it doesn't seem like this is a democracy in any way. They can just like it or leave, right?
Pretty much. And to be fair, a lot of residents are very happy with Ellison because, you know, it's a double-edged sword, his wealth. Because he is so rich, he's also been able to invest more back in the community. You know, he fixed up the community pool, he fixed up the movie theater, and he's helping students in various ways. But a lot of people just don't feel like it's enough and they feel like their lives are too controlled.
And so are people leaving the island?
I did talk to a few younger families who have recently moved off the island. One of them didn't want to speak on the record because they used to work for the company. And that is something that you run into a lot. There's just a lot of fear. But he said one of the main reasons is because it doesn't feel like their island anymore.
Sophie Alexander, wealth reporter for Bloomberg News, where you can read her article on Larry Ellison and his island, Lanai. Sophie, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, a new book on primates. Some are gender fluid, others are dominated by females.
And I've had objections to their behavior. I've given lectures about bonobos where, for example, an old male professor in Germany stood up and said, "What's wrong with those males?" As if it was the fault of the males that the females were dominant.
Primatologist Franz Duval is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Gender, sex, and sexuality are sensitive topics these days in the United States. They're the subjects of political battles over what kids should be taught, who gets to use the bathroom, even what is considered child abuse. Because we're all still grappling with how much of gender and sex is nature versus nurture, biological versus cultural. Franz Duval is a world-renowned primatologist and professor of primate behavior in the Department of Psychology at Emory University in Atlanta. He has studied animal behavior for more than four decades, and his latest book, he explores what we might learn about sex and gender from our closest primate relatives, mainly chimpanzees and bonobos. The book is called Different: Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist, and Franz Duval joins me now. Welcome.
I'm glad to be there.
I'm glad to have you. All right. Well, first, explain why we are so close genetically to chimpanzees and bonobos.
Well, we belong to the primate order. The primate order is very big, has a lot of monkeys in it. Monkeys have tails. We belong to the apes. We are basically apes in the eyes of a primatologist. We are large, tailless primates. And that brings us close to the apes, such as gorillas, orangutans, chimpanzees, and bonobos. And the two closest are the last two, chimpanzees and bonobos. They are equally close to us.
I think most people are familiar with chimpanzees, but not so much bonobos. They're not studied as much as chimpanzees. Why?
Yeah, they were discovered later, and they were considered small chimpanzees. They were called pygmy chimpanzees. At the San Diego Zoo, that was the label on the enclosures for them. And they were not taken seriously. Scientists were not really, they thought the chimpanzee is the real close relative and the bonobo can be ignored. Now we know a lot more about bonobos and we know that they're actually quite different in their behavior from the chimpanzee. And so now we're really getting interested in them.
Well, tell us how they differ.
Oh, they differ in so many ways. They're a bit smaller than the chimpanzee, but they, especially they're peaceful. There are no observed killings of one bonobo on another, which is very different from the chimpanzee. They have a lot of sex, and not just in male-female combinations, but in all sorts of combinations. And the females are dominant over the males. They're collectively dominant. They're not individually, because the females are smaller than the males. But collectively, they in all zoo groups that they know, and also in the wild, the females dominate the males. And for that reason, they were marginalized, and they maybe still are marginalized by the anthropologists, because they like a male-dominated species a lot better. But, you know, we have to take them seriously, because they are genetically exactly equally close to us as the chimps. So there's no good reason to marginalize them.
Yeah. Well, they sound like a more fun-loving bunch anyway, so, yeah.
Yeah, they're the hippies of the primate world. And I've had, you know, I've had objections to their behavior. I've given lectures about bonobos where, for example, an old male professor in Germany stood up and said, "What's wrong with those males?" As if it was the fault of the males that the females were dominant, you know?
Well, it's interesting. So I guess they're less warlike, you say, and that's mm-hmm. because the females are dominant? Is that the idea?
That could be part of it, because the females are less territorial than the males. And so mm-hmm. when bonobo groups meet each other, the females want to hang out together. They will groom each other between different groups. Their kids will be playing with each other. The males may have some lingering territoriality, but they're not very violent. In chimpanzees, of course, when groups meet, it's really like a war. They may kill each other. And bonobos, we know that they may share food. They even sometimes adopt between groups. So it's incredible. The females are much less hostile to other groups than the males are.
So primatologists and anthropologists, they study these animals to try to gain insights into how we behave, right? So what can you glean from studying bonobos and chimps? When it comes to our sexuality?
Yeah, it's a very complex comparison, because we have chimps and bonobos, which are very different characters to compare ourselves with. And in addition, it's not like if you look at the apes, what you see is biology. That's what people think. So if you look at humans, you see culture. If you see the apes, you see biology. But, you know, chimps and bonobos, they have a very slow development. They are adult when they're 16. Humans are adult when we're 18 or 20. So they are almost as slow as we are, which means that they learn a lot of things, and that's why they are slow. They need to learn a lot of things in their lifetime, including probably how to behave as a male and a female. And there's some evidence that young female primates copy their moms more, and young male primates copy the adult males around more. And so they learn their sex roles also from each other. So the term gender can be applied to them because gender relates to social expectations, society structure, and how we expect men and women to behave. So that whole concept of gender is applicable to the other primates, which makes the comparison so complex. And so I'm afraid that I have not written a simple book. I have written a book that is about the complexity of the comparison. And it is hard in that mass of complexity to see what is the biological component, because biology interacts so much with society and with the mm-hmm. culture. There is no pure biology. It doesn't really exist. It always interacts with the environment.
Right. So we're talking about gender, not sex, because sex is obviously binary. You have an XX or you have an XY chromosome,
sex
mainly.
Sex is mostly binary. It's an approximation. There is an in-between category also in humans, and I think it's probably 1% or 2%
that intersex.
So you always have to qualify. Sex is not really binary. Sex is mostly binary. And then gender, I usually don't divide in male and female. I divide gender in masculine and feminine and everything in between. And gender is a much more flexible concept and also can change, of course. Our gender values are going to change over time. And so gender is a much more flexible concept and is better not divided as a binary.
Right. But you wade into this minefield of gender in your book and try to figure out what is innate versus cultural. And it's obviously difficult to come down on one side or the other, impossible, in fact. But from observing chimpanzees and bonobos, where do you see gender expression coming from in a biological sense?
Well, it starts with the play behavior of the young. I think that's already where you see a major difference emerging between males and females. So young female primates, both in monkeys and apes, they're fascinated by infants. They want to hold infants. As soon as a mother arrives with a newborn, they want to hang around her and touch the infant. If they're older, they will become the babysitters for infants, because then the mother start to trust them. And if you give them dolls in captivity, you give them a teddy bear or something like that, they will hold it and carry it on their back and try to nurse it. In the wild, we know that young chimpanzee females may pick up a wooden log or a rock and put it on their back and carry it around. So the young females are fascinated by that. And this is true for both, for all the primates. And I think it's also true for girls more than for boys. And then the young males, they like to mock fight, play wrestling. What we call rough and tumble play has been found in all the primates. The males do it more than the females. And in all the human studies, boys do it more than girls. And so very early in life, we can see some major differences. They are averages, so they don't apply to every individual. But on average, the sex is different in that regard. And I think it is universal in human society, so culture cannot really explain that difference.
Hmm. So the apes are not being taught at a very young age that if they are female, that they should be interested in infants or play with doll-like objects.
No one is telling them to be like that, but they are like that. And there are experiments that have been done. Actually, one of them was done in LA, I believe, with monkeys, where they throw in human toys into a group of monkeys in captivity and see who picks up which toys. And the males will pick up balls and trucks, and the females will pick up dolls and teddy bears and so on. So the difference is pretty striking, and corresponds to a large degree with what we see in human society. So I don't think cultural, people always say that stereotypes, that's the word they use, but it's more like archetypes. It's mm-hmm. it's older than stereotypes.
But of course you see some fluidity too, right? Do you see some animals who are interested in both, or interested in roughhousing and also in nurturing infants?
Yeah. That's the interesting thing, is that I describe in my book a female chimpanzee named Donna, who from very young age, when she was just 3 years old, she already liked wrestling a lot more than most other females. And she looked for the adult male chimpanzees, the alpha male, in fact, to wrestle with her. And the males usually don't wrestle with young females, but in this case, they made an exception, which means that Donna was already different in her behavior. And when she grew into an adolescent and later into an adult, she grew into a sort of male-like character. She had big shoulders, big hair, big head. And she hung out with the males and wanted to be with the males. She acted like a male. And from a distance, if you didn't know better, you would swear she was a male. So we have these individuals. We also have them in the males. We have sometimes big males who could be dominant males, but they are not interested in the political games of males. They stay out of confrontations. They do other things. They groom more. And so they have... they have other interests, social interests, than being the dominant male. And so we have these exceptions. And that's why it's so interesting to apply the term gender to them, because I think the same gender diversity that we see in human society, if we start looking for it, I'm sure we're going to find it in primate societies too. And we as biologists, we're not really surprised by that, because in biology, we're very used to individual variability. But we have sort of neglected that in relation to sex. We have always looked for the typical behavior rather than the atypical behavior.
Well, let's talk more about Donna. So she uh-huh. hung out with the males. Mm-hmm. And did she also hang out with the females from time to time? Was she rejected by the females?
No, she was very well integrated. She was very well accepted. And she also hung out with females on occasion. So that's the interesting part. We have individuals who have a different sexual orientation. We have individuals who are more homosexual than heterosexual. We have individuals like Donna who don't really fit the mold of what you would expect for their sex. But I've never noticed that these individuals have trouble being accepted. I imagine that in a primate group, acceptance might be low for individuals who disturb the peace, who bother others. I think it would probably they might be rejected. But this kind of individuals like Donna, I've never seen any rejection or any hostile reaction to them.
And who would she have sex with, the males or the females?
Donna wasn't interested in sex. She was really sort of neutral in that regard. And so I usually call her asexual.
She was a chimp, not a bonobo. But do chimps mm-hmm. also have differing sexual orientations? We talked about the bonobos having sex every which way, but do the chimps do as well?
Yeah. So bonobos I would call bisexual in the sense mm-hmm. that I don't think they have a strong preference for one gender or the other in their behavior. And females especially have a lot of sex with other females. In the chimpanzee, you see that behavior also, not as intense and not as frequent as in the bonobo. The bonobo has a lot higher frequency of sexual contact, but in the chimpanzee, you can see these behaviors also. So in all the primates, we see some homosexual activity. And so that's also why that whole argument that homosexual behavior is unnatural, that is sometimes used, that really doesn't hold up very well if you look at the other primates.
Why are they having so much sex? It's obviously not for procreation if they're doing it all the time.
Yeah, so the bonobos have an enormous amount of sex. I would say 3/4 of their sexual activity has nothing to do with reproduction, because it is between individuals who cannot reproduce or who are already pregnant or something like that. And so it has to do with conflict resolution. Actually, the easiest way to get sex among bonobos at the zoo is to give them food, because the food introduces competition and the competition needs to be resolved. And they do that by having sex. They really make love, not war primates. And they do that in the wild also. When bonobos enter a fruit tree where there's an enormous amount of food, they first have sex and then they climb around and take the food. And so sex is a conflict resolution mechanism. It is not used. People always think that bonobos have sex the whole day. These are brief contacts. You know, it's different. They have 10 seconds, 15 seconds. That's a long time for bonobos. They have very brief sexual contacts, which sort of smooth the relationships.
So they don't climax necessarily.
Oh, they climax in 10 seconds. Oh. They can climb.
Wow. Okay.
And you can see that and hear that. It's a very loud noise that they make. And there are actually, that's very long ago, people did some laboratory studies on primates and found that female orgasm exists in the other primates. All the primates, and in fact, all the mammals have a clitoris. So a mouse has a clitoris and an elephant has a clitoris. And the biggest clitorises that we find in the animal kingdom are in the dolphin and the bonobo. And those happen to be both species in which there's a lot of female-female sex going on.
Well, you write that other primates take every individual as they come without hang-ups about whether they can conform to the majority, which is interesting because I thought in other animal species, the runt or the outlier was rejected often or maybe eaten, but not so with primates?
Only in extreme cases. There was a recent case of an albino chimpanzee baby that was born in the wild and was rejected by the group, because that's a very drastic difference in color. But other than that, I don't know cases where that's common, that they reject someone. And certainly not on the basis of, I think, their sexual behavior or sexual preferences. I don't think that's a common thing. I think we humans have a tendency to label. I think that's a problematic thing. We are a symbolic species and we like pigeonholes and we label everybody. You're a man, you're a woman, you're homosexual, you're heterosexual. We label all these things. And if you don't follow these labels, if you fall somewhere in between, we don't know what to do with you. And human society is intolerant of individuals who don't really fit the labels. And in the other primates, that's really not an issue. They don't label. And so the pigeonholing that they have is very vague and doesn't really apply in the same way.
Well, it's a fascinating book. And thank you for a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, thank you. You're welcome.
That's Frans de Waal. He is a primatologist and author of Different: Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. Coming up, planning a picnic. Evan Kleiman is here with ideas for wine in a can. Yes, a can. Better than a box. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
Well, it is the season to eat outdoors. Maybe take a picnic to the beach, the Hollywood Bowl, or anywhere else. One of the fairly recent innovations in the wine industry makes drinking a glass of wine outdoors a lot easier. Evan Kleiman is here with some tips for enjoying canned wine. She's the host of KCRW's Good Food. Hi.
Hi. Perhaps we should say wine in cans.
Sounds gross, canned wine, I have to say. I know. It just doesn't sound like high quality would be in a can.
Well, I think for many years, high quality wasn't in a can. And still, I would say that the majority of wine in cans is commodity wine, so not great. But there are a lot of reasons that premium winemakers are now looking at the can as something great for them, and they're using it. So there's much more opportunity to find excellent wine in a can now.
Well, how have they made it so you don't get the can taste?
We'll just pour it into a glass.
Oh, okay. But it hasn't infused the wine already from sitting in there?
No, because it's not, it's aluminum. It's a neutral metal. It's not like, you know, the cans of yore.
Yeah. Well, are there some varietals more appropriate to a can than others?
Definitely. All of the wine shop owners and sommeliers I've spoken with say that the ones that you should really look at when you're choosing what kind of wine in a can to drink are those that are meant to be drunk young. So you're not looking for vintage wines that need aging in a bottle with a cork, because, you know, there is this air exchange in a bottle with a cork, and it interacts with what's in the bottle. And that is very important for wines that you, you know, lay down to age. These are not those wines.
Okay. So you have reached out to some local wine cellars for some tips. And what have you heard back?
Well, it seems that a lot of them are really enjoying natural wines in cans, and more than one has name-checked Las Haras Waves Rosé in a can. And I should say that most of them say that the wines that are best served by being in a can are things that you imagine would be good chilled. So rosé, bubbles, white wine, and some light reds. And I think one of the most important things about wineries deciding to put some wine in cans is the carbon footprint is so much lower. And it seemed that when people started ordering more alcohol online than they ever had before at the beginning of the pandemic, that was the push that some winemakers needed to get through the pandemic and send their product all over the country and have it weigh less.
So I mentioned the Hollywood Bowl in the intro, and Carolyn Stein, who is co-owner of and wine director of the Luke Group of Restaurants and is the wine director of Hollywood Bowl Food and Wine, she spoke to the LA Times about what she likes in a good canned wine. What did she say?
Yeah, I was really eager to read this article because I have so much respect for her. And pretty much that's what she said. She said the things to look for are wines meant to be drunk young. And some of her recommendations are the Sommelier curated brand Nomadica, Farm Strong Field Red, Scribe Winery's Una Lu Rosé, and Scarpetta Wine's Frico Frizzante. We have a link to that article so you can read more about it. And then we, of course, have links to all of those wines.
I can imagine if you're drinking wine in a can, you might be thinking you're not drinking that much and you might just guzzle one or two or three cans, but there's a lot of wine in those cans, right?
Yeah. One of the wine sellers I spoke to was Jill Bernheimer of Domain LA. And she said that people forget that a 375 milliliter can is actually a half bottle of wine. So she says, beware when drinking cans at a barbecue or pool party, because they're deceptive and they actually read smaller than their actual volume.
Right. So you might think it's kind of like drinking a canned soda, but it's not.
Yeah. Or a beer, which is generally much lower in alcohol than wine. But, you know, there are canned wines that come in smaller packages. Some do come in 250 milliliter. And there are minis like Coppola's Blanc de Blanc Sophia that comes in 185 milliliter cans. Yeah, these cans are sold in four packs generally, and that makes one four pack equivalent to a generous two bottles of wine, which is something to remember when you're looking at the price.
Would you bring one of these four packs as a hostess gift if you were going to a dinner party?
I mean, if it was a great wine, I might bring it to a dinner party as a conversation starter. I would definitely bring it where we're going to be eating outside or by a pool or to a potluck. I think it's also, if you're a host and you don't want to rely on what people are bringing to you to drink, that it's a great way to have a lot of variety in your wine offerings for guests. And you could just throw everything in a cooler along with your beer and your water. And I think people would really enjoy it.
I think so too. It's a great summer drink. Great idea.
And you know, as with all wines, we have so many great independent wine stores here in the county that range all throughout our geography. And almost all of them are carrying a few cans, some of them a lot, some of them less. And so I would lean on the expertise of the wine sellers for what to get, just as you would when you're buying a bottle of wine, because their inventory with cans seems to rotate very quickly. And so they may not always have something that's name checked by me or you know, in the LA Times article.
Okay, good advice. Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food, which you can hear on the radio Saturday mornings at 10 or wherever you get your podcasts. Evan, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, speaking of podcasts, you can download the Press Play podcast at kcrw.com. That's also where you can get the Good Food podcast. So there you go. You're all set for your summer. You've got podcasts and wine. What more do you want? I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.